You're listening to Teatro Mundi Live. I'm Andrea Cetrullo, Program Curator at Teatro Mundi, and this is the second episode of Hybrids, a podcast series focusing on the notion of hybridity as mixture, contamination, and symbiosis. How do apparently distinct entities, be they human or not, interact, feed from each other, and combine their individualities in order to create something entirely new? We invited four guests to answer this question through the lens of choreography, architecture, medical history, mathematics, ecology, and gastronomy. On this occasion, I am joined by dancer and professor of performance and the humanities at King's College London, author of the book Choreomania, Dance and Disorder, Kelina Gottmann. In her book, Kelina engages with archival materials to understand the term choreomania, or dancing madness, initially employed to describe contagious popular dances, from antiquarian references to ancient Greek bacchanals and medieval St. Vitus's dances, to scientific re-performances of early modern religious ecstasies and American government anthropology. Choreomania arose to signal every gestural and choreographic unrest. But how contagious was this dancing disease, and was it actually categorized as a disease throughout history? So, welcome, Kelina, to this episode of Hybrids, where we'll be speaking about your work on choreomania.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
No, thank you. So, I would like us to start this conversation by unpacking the subject of your book, Choreomania, Dance and Disorder. Could you please tell us what the word choreomania means and what it denotes?
Yes, very much. So choreomania, I work in this book with as a kind of a double concept. So on the one hand, choreomania, dance mania, dancing disease, Tanzwut are a whole bunch of different terms that were used largely in the 19th century in historical medical circles, but also in previous centuries through different Latin versions, to describe a kind of combination of unruly gestures, sometimes dancing, sometimes not actually dancing, sometimes just dance-like movement, sometimes slightly contagious. It's a grab bag term that I recognized as occurring in a lot of different forms of literature. When I say literature, I don't mean fictional literature so much as sort of medical literature, early anthropology, early ethnography. So I'm interested in the way that language emerged to describe, to try to name a whole bunch of different things as if they were a singular thing, really a medical diagnosis and a psychiatric diagnosis, a diagnosis of a kind of form of epidemic madness that involved dancing gestures. The way I also use the term is to critique this. So in the way that, for example, Edward Said uses Orientalism to describe what had been an academic discipline that described supposedly the Orient from, you know, Syria and China to India, he uses this to then critique that sort of ideology. So for me, choreomania is something that I deploy in the mode of critique to describe the way that this term was used to bring together a whole bunch of really very, very different sorts of movements, gestures, attitudes, moments in history, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And could you talk about how choreomania, this concept that we're discussing, has appeared under different terms throughout history?
Yeah. So the term itself, on some level, really comes into force in the 19th century. So the German historian of medicine, Hecker, whom I read very closely and whose work I follow, uses the notion of Tanzwut or dancing madness to describe things that in their own times were called alternately St. John's dances or St. Vitus's dances. He looks at the convulsionaries of Samedar in Paris in the 1730s. He looks at a whole lot of tarantellas. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of different moments in history where, you know, either through a religious procession or another form of kind of cultural practice, people were engaged in some form of dancing or dance-like movement. It's only retrospectively that these really get grouped together. So in the 1370s, the sort of main so-called dancing mania that Hecker's interested in, and that then gets repeated over and over again in different forms of medical and neurological literature, and then in popular literature, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So this is something that was generally to some extent called St. John's dances. In the 1340s, there were already what were called plague dances. And these were used in the, you know, Latin and vernacular languages, pest tants, or to describe kind of village dances that people did during plague to try to ward off death. You know, you have narratives of kind of two monks riding through and see some people dancing, and they say, why are you dancing? And they say, well, we don't want death to come here, you know, and then the monks report driving back through town later and everybody had died. And so they figure, okay, well, that plague dance. Yeah. And, you know, there are reports of things like, you know, hexen tants or kind of witches, mats and dances and such. And in the 1370s, so a few years later, after the real height of the Black Death, which is more towards 1348, 1350, there's a kind of, it's not even a resurgence, it's more like an intensification of processional dances. There are all kinds of ways in which people are moving through public space in quite a sort of outlandish way. They're the flagellants, you know, who are hyper-religious characters who kind of whip themselves through town. And it's not 100% clear who these dancers were who would come through town. Some of the reports suggest they were pilgrims. They definitely attracted some attention. It's hard to know whether there was more of that going on in the 1370s or it was just more remarked upon by clerics. But they were described by clerical bystanders. Obviously, the only written records are by the people who could write, which were generally the religious people, etc. So they were described as kind of being possessed by demons, and they were dancing around, and some of them had campsites outside town. And, you know, you try to imagine what this was. And to my mind, the descriptions of these people, there's some Latin chronicles from the time that, you know, describe them. It almost seems a bit like a kind of hippie-ish encampment or a Hare Krishna-esque, like people who are a bit outside the kind of mode of being in the village, and who are therefore noteworthy, who come with kind of color and song and speaking maybe potentially a slightly different language, Hungarian pilgrims potentially, who are, you know, coming through and more into Western Europe. So they get noticed, but they don't get noticed in a very hyperbolic way. They get noticed as kind of, they're noteworthy, but they're not alarming. And there's certainly nothing of the sort of epidemic language that you get in the 19th century, when people reading these accounts are saying, ooh, and who are interested in epidemics, because there's the cholera epidemic and all of that. And they're kind of trying to find, well, Hecker is the first, you know, historian of chair, you know, professor of the history of medicine. And I think his work is brilliant. But so he was interested in epidemics of the Middle Ages. And he looks at the Black Death and what this so-called sweating sickness and the dancing mania. And so he's kind of forging a field of historical epidemiology. But the work that I did when I started my project, I thought I was looking at a whole bunch of different dancing manias, ancient Greece, and all these different sort of ecstatic practices. And then what I realized was that actually when I dug into each one of these so-called different episodes, there was very little madness, very little collective dancing frenzy, and mostly the episodes, so-called, were really quite banal. Some pilgrims dancing around a little bit. So I guess it's a long way to answer your question, but to say that the different terms that were used in their contexts include St. John's dances. In the 16th century, you start to hear more about St. Vitus's dances. St. Vitus was the patron saint of, you know, mad dog bites and, you know, falling sickness. And there are different forms of uncontrolled movement, including epilepsy, which has nothing to do with dancing whatsoever, end up kind of getting collected together. And then, you know, the saint is described as, you know, protecting people. And what you end up getting is, for example, you know, there's been a lot of hoo-ha recently because of some quite sensationalizing characterizations of 1518 Strasbourg. But that's a very different situation where you have much more in a within a municipal setting, basically people just doing a lot of partying. I don't know why they were partying. They were dancing. They had hired musicians. And it was seen to be getting a little bit out of hand. So the municipal authorities were brought in. And then the people would get, you know, maybe taken to the church so they'd chill out a little bit, which I think probably it would sober you up if you have to kind of, you know, you get carted off to go to the church and maybe you'll stop dancing at that point because you're kind of, you've sobered up or whatever. But at that point, especially because you get a lot of early modern medical opinion coming in, people like Paracelsus writing about this, there's a whole set of new authorities that are talking about what this dancing is and how to cure it. And so that again, you know, it's hard to say really. It when you look at it, you think, okay, well, you know, people seem to have been for a period of time in a bit of a giddy state where they were kind of staying up all night doing some dancing a bit, and that ended up seeming like it was disruptive to the regular workday. So then, you know, they were trying to be stopped. But it's not an epidemic, right? It's not a kind of, it's a bit of enthusiasm. Is that a dancing mania? I don't know, right? It gets described as such. And to me, what's interesting, and this is my sort of Foucauldian lens, what's interesting to me is it kind of like the way that he describes, you know, he's not interested to try to characterize what madness is, but what things have been described in those terms. And for me, this is the same thing in the sense that I don't have very much interest in declaring whether something is or is not a dancing mania, because I don't think that's really interesting necessarily. But I do find myself very interested in seeing in what ways various different events have been described in terms of a dancing disease. And I wonder, you know, why? What on earth is a dancing disease? I mean, that's a weird, to me, that set of terms is already so paradoxical and so bizarre. And I just think, you know, how do you even get to a point where somebody is cataloging all of these different fairly banal events? And I could, you know, I could go on with different examples of what have been described. I mean, the convulsionaries of Samida were just basically some religious people who would go visit the tomb of this guy who's a Jansenist and get cured. That has nothing to do with dancing. There was some enthusiasm around this for a time. It's a bit of a popular movement in the sense of generally sort of poorer classes, stuff going on in Kentucky and Tennessee that some neurologists were looking at, you know, which are more properly neurological disorders that involve involuntary movement. So what I realized was that the common denominator to make something be described as choreomania tended to be that it involved some form of either involuntary or seemingly involuntary motion. Now, if you're having a dance party, is that involuntary? I don't know. You ask, you know what I'm saying? You tell me, right? And kind of what's the distinct, why is it interesting to distinguish between voluntary and involuntary motion? So that's where some of my analysis starts to come in terms of the way these describe a kind of ideological, philosophical, you know, understanding as to what's normal and what's not normal behavior. Not always groups, sometimes singular people. The Tarantellas were generally women on their own. Something that sort of had a quality of exuberance, generally gendered female, whether or not it was actually women, generally increasingly as the colonial literature was starting to come in and add to Hecker's initial set of studies raced dark. And this is where the medieval and the colonial, mostly African, but also to some extent aspects of the South American as well, start to get kind of seen as, you know, there's this otherness, right? The Dominus, it's always sort of other relative to a kind of white modern European sort of supposed capacity for self-control, etc. So Coriomenius end up sort of designating people moving in a way that appears to be more too much. There's a too muchness to the gesture in appearance. There's a sort of seeming unproductiveness. And there's a sort of irregularity or jaggedness to the motion. To me, these on their own don't signal in value terms good or bad, right? I have no particular preference or concern as to whether somebody is moving in a more smooth or rigid way or in a more outlandish way. But it does seem that at this time, repeat the narratives that are repeated over and over again with variation seem to call dancing diseases or dancing manias or St. Vitus's dances, whether they're neurological conditions or village fetes or revolts, you know, an anti-government revolt in Madagascar, Native American, the Sioux and other tribes in anti-government protest, basically in North America in the 1890s, all of these get compared to, you know, St. Vitus's dance and other forms of so-called dancing disease. And that's what's interesting to me. You know, what is at stake in that comparison? Why is that comparison taking place?
As you were speaking, I was thinking, Kalina, as well, about Charcot, Dr. Yeah. Charcot, who you mention in your book. I did know about him because he's not such a well-known figure, but he was hugely influential on Freud.
Yes.
Who everybody knows. Yeah. So, yes, I think he was quite fascinated. He had a particular fascination for hysterical women.
Yeah.
So if you could tell us a little bit about that, because that takes into 20th century, I guess, territory.
Yeah, well, he was before, so he was Freud's teacher. So he was really working mostly in the very late 19th century. Mm-hmm. But he is incredibly important. I mean, he was the first, if Hecker was the first chaired professor of the history of medicine, Charcot was the first neurologist, really. And it's not only hysterical women, but also he was very interested in hysterical men. But mm-hmm. the women ended up really taking more of the imagination subsequently and kind of being disproportionately remembered on some level. Also because there was quite a lot of literature around the way they were maybe slightly influenced by him to kind of perform some of their convulsive, you know, behaviors on stage, and whether there was a whole kind of power magnetism thing going on. So one of the things that he does, and he works very closely with Paul Richer, who is an illustrator and a close collaborator also within the sort of neurological realm, and others, to try to determine what were kind of strictly neurological forms of so-called hysterical behavior. And what was hysteroepilepsy? So hysteroepilepsy looks like epilepsy, sort of, not really, but kind of-ish, but isn't. And it has a more of a hysterical origin. So one of the things they did was they, you know, in keeping with the 19th century way of doing science, which is really quite different from what it is now, they were really interested in also the history of these different behaviors and attitudes and sort of positions of the body and such. So they did a whole lot of iconographic research in churches, and they were looking at kind of ways that, you know, people are depicted in kind of ecstatic poses and such to find precedents for what they were diagnosing as hysteroepilepsy. And that, interestingly, it comes after Hecker, but they read Hecker and they kind of continue some of Hecker's project. And interestingly, the neurological link then gets followed into Brazil, where there's a physician who is trained under Chaco, who goes and then says, you know, here's a case of maybe hysteroepilepsy, or maybe, you know, and it's an interesting link, because it's one of those moments where you have these neurologists, Osler, who was another sort of medical professional, and there are a whole slew of them. A lot of them are complaining because some of these, so chorea minor and chorea major are terms that come into the medical vocabulary. Chorea minor is a kind of neurological condition that involves dance-like involuntary movement. As far as I can understand, and I've, you know, it is a very, when I say it's a very real condition, it, you know, diagnoses are always historically contingent to an extent, and there's never a hard and fast border between one and another diagnosis. But to the extent that so-called, you know, that chorea minor, sometimes Huntington's disease is a sort of similar disease that was described by Huntington, involve involuntary movements that are dance-like but have nothing to do with dancing. So that in the medical literature is distinguished from chorea major, which was supposedly these, you know, episodes of dancing in the 1370s and elsewhere that had more of a kind of epidemic mode. And all of these different medical writers, Chaco and others, are all complaining about, and Osler has a brilliant little description of this, they're all complaining about the fact that St. Vitus dance, chorea minor, chorea major, that all of these have a similar set of words, but they're completely different things. And yet, even though, and chorea obviously is the Latin for dance, so even though they are seemingly, you know, they are acknowledging the fact that these are completely different things, still the terminology, even while they're recognizing that the terminology confuses it, the terminology continues to confuse it. So even now when you read medical journals, there is still in a lot of, you know, the archives of neurology and other sort of sections of journals and such, they'll still talk about, they'll still situate next to one another within a paragraph or whatnot, chorea minor, chorea major. And it's that weird terminological proximity that seems to somehow continue to weave a narrative of apparent sameness or apparent relation when these really have nothing to do with one another, right? If somebody's suffering from a tremor in their arm, that's very different from somebody dancing at a party in Strasbourg, or somebody, you know, involved in an uprising against a king, or involved in an uprising against a government. They have nothing to do with one another, but the terminology continues to kind of weave these together so that neuromotor disorders, village fets, all of these things end up seeming to partake in a similar genealogy. Now, if you're talking about hybridity, to my mind, this is really one of the ways that, you know, these forms, which some of which are all dance, part movement, you know, dance anyway is somewhere in a borderline between something that is a crafted, artful shaping of movement in space and time, or however you want to describe it. And, you know, I mean, what's the limit between a dance and a not dance, right? I mean, this is something that the Judson Dance Theater obviously experimented with in terms of pedestrian gestures. If you bob your head a little bit at, you know, to some music, or you dancing, if you put your arms out and do things, but it's not really very spirited or very artful, is that dancing? You know, so I, again, I'm not interested necessarily on an ontological level in the difference between dance and not dance, but I am interested in ways that the language of the choreic or of chorea enters into medical language and then into popular language and anthropological language and psychology and social psychology and crowd theory in relation to disease, in relation to disorder. And disorder is really the crunch point, because it's really both a social disorder, the line between a social disorder, a social disruption, and something that is a natural medical disease of some sort is a bit messy most of the time.
Yes, and probably elaborating on that point, I would like to ask if you think there is actually, you did kind of touch upon it already, but do you think there is a contagious aspect to choreomania?
It depends how you describe contagious. Mm-hmm. So I think that enthusiasm, different modes of emotion can be, you know, if people around you are all in a bad mood or all in a good mood, is that going to make you in a bad or a good mood? It might and it might not. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of interesting kind of social psychology and other forms that, you know, that study these sorts of affective emotional forms of, you know, contagion and such. If you catch a cold from somebody or if you catch COVID from somebody or whatever, I think, but I'm not, you know, a medical expert in this regard, I think that's a different kind of contagion. So I think there's one form that's slightly more metaphorical and one form that's slightly more mm-hmm. biological. And of course, a kind of messy place in between that involves sort of affect and such. To my mind, a group of people dancing together, you take again, for example, the Sioux Uprising, the ghost dance in the 1890s, huge widespread protest against the US government, you know, reneging on treaties, not providing food, you know, basically mass starvation. I mean, it was a, you know, essentially a genocidal moment in the history of American governmentality. And a whole lot of the Native American people were resisting this by doing ghost dancing, which was mm-hmm. to call up the dead and to try to band together and to find solidarity together. Is that contagious? No, of course not. Not, I mean, or it is, but in a positive sense, you know what I mean? I mean, and that's where to me, you know, if one band is talking to another band and saying, we're going to gather, we're going to, you know, do this. So what's interesting is where contagion is described in negative terms as something that is involuntary and that is that is sort of against your will, right? So there are two problems with that, or two issues that are interesting. One is sometimes it is entirely in your will to do something with other people, whether it's to have a dance party or, you know, protest or so. It might seem contagious in that numbers are spreading, and that might be upsetting to somebody who doesn't want those numbers to spread. Is it, so do you call that contagion? Do you not call that contagion? I don't know. But there's another thing which is interesting and important too, and that is the sort of moral judgment that's implied in calling something involuntary, right? So a lot of the choreomania discourse in the medical literature primarily, suggests and assumes contagiousness and epidemic as something, obviously epidemic is kind of contagion on a kind of more mass level, although it's not always used in mass terms, but as something that would be bad, right? And I kind of think, well, to some extent, it's good to be a rational being and to have agency. But sometimes it's also okay to let go and to not be willful and to enter into an altered state of consciousness in which you are in an involuntary way being moved or whatever, right? So I think it's a tricky question, again, in terms of sort of what the language is aiming to imply and morally and also, you know, technically. And that's where I would, as with many of these things in relation to, you know, the language of choreomania and such, I would sort of withhold any distinctive judgment on whether something is contagious or no, without all of those caveats as to kind of what you mean by and, you know, how that language gets used.
Yes, yeah. You do mention this in your book,
that there is often a fear of what you're just describing, joy, oblivion, altered states, and so which presumably in these accounts lead to unproductivity or some kind of unproductivity. So how has this alleged unproductivity been considered a threat for society, and by whom?
Yeah, the most marked cases of critique of unproductivity is with the ghost dance, which wasn't very distinctly described in choreomania terms. It was sort of 1890s, so this comes later, but I include this in my analysis because James Mooney, who was an ethnographer, did in his very important study of the ghost dance of 1890 compare them to sort of Shakers, St. Vitus dancers, etc. And I think it continues the genealogy in part with that language, but also because of the set of narratives and the discourse that surrounded the way that played out in the emerging media and in different forms of anthropological and other literature also. But in those cases, and because it was involving the US government and US government agents, so-called Indian agents on the Indian territories at the time, there is a lot of material and a lot of kind of telegrams back and forth. And the settlers were very worried that the Indians were spending all night dancing and that fields were lying to waste, et cetera. The US Indian agents were as well. And a lot of what the telegrams and the correspondence between Washington, DC and the different territories, Oklahoma Territory and other sort of, again, Indian territories of the time, different people were trying to find different solutions, and they were saying, put a dollar in their pocket and that'll teach them to, adhere to the American way. So it's a real ideological warfare that's going on that has to do with a clash between a kind of work dollar centered economy on the one hand, and what appeared to be a resistance to that. Now, the complex, difficult, and really incredibly heartbreaking doesn't even begin to describe how just terrible it is as a period in history. There was a massacre. The US government troops came in and killed a lot of the ghost dancers. One of the issues is really around the fact that the treaties had been broken and they weren't being given the rations that they had been promised. They were being, essentially starved. They were being essentially, their land was being taken away. Gold had been found. So there's a kind of clash of civilizations that's going on, in which dance seems to be the sort of cipher through which to show that, these Indians don't really want to be good citizens and productively hoe the land and productively, learn the English language and do their schooling, and they're kind of wasting their time and energy to dance. But also, they've been absolutely and completely crushed by the government rescinding, reneging on the treaties and such. And so it's both the fact that there are completely different views of how one lives and the fact that there's a real crisis. The buffalo or population is decimated at the time because the crops are failing, because etc. So that is really a case where the language of unproductivity is situated in government discourse, and to the extent that the military is brought in to repress so-called agitators. Mm-hmm. And I think that, when you get into early 20th century dances and such that kind of get described as St. Vitus-like, there's also a kind of spirit of, the jitterbug and rock and roll. And again, these, to my mind, is it a dance mania? I don't use that term to describe moments. I read how things are discussed. I read the language with which different events are described. But there is always a sort of sense that people who are, you know, expending their energy and time to do dancing of this sort, for example, are then too tired to work the next day or whatever. Is that always the case? I don't know, not necessarily. But it definitely creates an ideology in which, you know, a certain form of movement, a certain form of relationship to time, a certain form of relationship to energy are all getting, you know, becoming normative and in contrast to this discourse. So this discourse sort of shows that against which modern productivist, you know, productivist modernity is kind of becoming established.
I was interested in hearing more about how this performativity or, you know, these exaggerated movements have empowered to a certain extent, oppressed people to create space for themselves in like regimented, highly surveilled places, such as our modern cities. How does this empowerment manifest more concretely or through examples?
I don't know that there's always empowerment necessarily. And I think surveilled spaces are really far more contemporary in some ways. I think that, for example, the Canudos Revolt, again, around the same period, similar to the ghost dance, very late 19th century. This is a bit of a messianic movement. People who were kind of divested of participation in the nation state, get together and have visions and such. I don't know that there's necessarily empowerment. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a feeling of solidarity, or in my analysis of the 1863 Madagascar, the Ramanenjana, which was described by a Scottish missionary physician as a form of dancing disease, a form of dancing mania. In that case, what he was witnessing were people who were getting together, tapping into the old shamanistic practices that did involve possession, like movements, et cetera, mm-hmm. and that were adhering to forms of recognized and habitual forms of governmentality by which, if you're not happy with a regent, you can, you know, kick them out, basically. And the king had been, again, there were issues with treaty rights with the Europeans, and he was being seen as selling the land, et cetera. So I've called this ecstasy belonging. And it's a way of describing the fact that there's a sort of ecstatic, there's a sort of feeling of being outside regular time and outside regular body patterns. And through that, having a sort of the power of banding together. So I think there are a lot of ways in which when people come together in whatever form, they can feel stronger, mm-hmm. and become stronger, don't just feel stronger fictitiously, but mm-hmm. are in fact stronger.
Well, this brings us to the last question. I would like to know more about your experience as a dancer, mm-hmm. and whether this has influenced your research or informed it to a certain extent.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I have a very gated background as a dancer. So I was trained in very classical dance from very young. I did contemporary, I did modern, I did all kinds of things. But I was also quite a kind of dancing person in any other occasion that I could find, from moves to mosh pits to whatever. And for me, it was formative to my life growing up in Montreal. We were always dancing. I remember when I moved to New York for the first time, I didn't really understand where you could go dancing. Where do you go dancing? And, you know, the cabaret laws were still in effect from the Prohibition era. So in the time of the Prohibition, some what were called cabaret laws came into effect, which suggests that there are establishments where it's legal to dance and establishments where it's not legal to dance.
Is that in New York?
in New York. Yeah. So, and if you don't, and I maybe throughout the U.S., one of the many catalysts to this project, although the project was born the seed of the project was, you know, came before that event, but that was one of the catalysts when I actually started to work on this in earnest. And I thought, wow, how insane is this? And there was this one place I was told, you have to go to the Bulgarian place. And the Bulgarian place was on Broadway or something in Chinatown. And for $10, you could bring your own and you go up some rickety steps. And DJ Eugene Holtz from Global Bordello was up there spinning like this Balkan. And people were just dancing like, you know, like just normal, right? Like just going a bit crazy and all kinds of different people. And, you know, and I just thought, how completely bizarre is it, you know, in New York City right now, in, you know, that you have to go to this unmarked place. Oh, no, it was on the Bowery. Mm-hmm. This unmarked place on the Bowery to go and for a tenner, like, you know, and obviously you could line up to a club, but that kind of the normality of being able to, you know, dance, hang out with your friends, you know, et cetera, not in a kind of deliberate way.
It sounds very Victorian, like a sanitizing of bodily functions or anything that is deemed as like dirty or, yeah.
Very much. It's very much. And it's really, this is really a story of 19th century colonial, of a 19th century colonial gaze. And when I say colonial, I don't mean just in the colonies, but it's very much. And when I started working on this and I thought I was looking at all these different dance manias, I was initially really annoyed that so many of my sources were in the 19th century, which I thought was not at all an interesting century, at the time. And too many of them were medical. And I was like, well, this isn't what I set out to read about. And then I realized quite quickly that actually it's because what I was analyzing was a 19th century medical imaginary. And that was really the crux of it, was that it was, you know, this whole concept, you know, cluster of notions really emerged with force, really kind of gained traction and spread and moved around and moved across different disciplines within a 19th century imaginary. And I think it's very significant that and then, you know, it moves into the 20th. And of course, there's some precedent. But the particular forms of judgment, the particular language, the particular discourse that's really taking hold at that time is absolutely of its era and absolutely engaged in a sort of civilizing process and engaged in making the distinction on some level between what is so, you know, civilized and not civilized, or, you know, proper and improper kinds of behaviors.
Well, thank you so much, Kalina, for sharing all of this work and thoughts. And yes, just thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure.